This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Welcome back to our weekly series about inequality in the Baltimore region, The Lines Between Us. Last week, we looked at the obstacles ex-offenders run into when they try to find a job. Our guests discussed the risk of recidivism, how without training, supports, and obviously jobs, relapse into crime becomes likely.
If, in fact, you're not going to give people the opportunity to make a living, they're going to resort to going back to lives of crime if that's what they're used to.
Today we want to highlight another type of cycle, the generational cycle of incarceration, lived out by many families in Baltimore and specifically in six communities in the city. We want to know what factors lead multiple family members of multiple generations to become incarcerated, and we want to highlight solutions and interventions that can interrupt the cycle. In a few minutes, we'll speak with an ex-offender who now works to break that cycle. But joining me now is Dr. Nancy Levine, director of the Justice Policy Center at the Urban Institute. Dr. Levine, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you are very familiar with Baltimore's prison and reentry population. 10 years ago, in 2003, you published a report, A Portrait of Prisoner Reentry in Maryland. Which communities are most ex-offenders returning to in Baltimore?
Well, we identified six communities in total: Southwest Baltimore, Greater Rosemont, Sandtown, Winchester / Harlem Park, Greenmount, Clifton, Berea, and Southern Park Heights.
Yeah, and you wrote that some of those communities are receiving as many returning prisoners as whole counties elsewhere.
That's right. And if you look at the rate of return, it's really quite high. Not just the numbers of people returning, but the rate per existing residence. In Southwest Baltimore, for example, 127 returning prisoners per 1,000 residents, and that's just in 1 year alone. So if you can imagine that number accruing over multiple years, I mean, we're talking about communities that are just really getting devastated by the removal and return of these vulnerable people.
Well, yeah, tell us a bit about what these communities are like.
Well, perhaps not surprisingly, across a lot of the socioeconomic measures that we look at researchers, they tend to be more distressed, more disadvantaged neighborhoods. So they're more likely to have households that are receiving types of public assistance, more likely to have female-headed households with no husbands present. They're more likely to have lower levels of income overall.
And are these communities with a high crime rate?
Yes and no would be the answer. We looked at what we call Part 1 crimes, which are the most serious types of crimes, rape, robbery, homicide, burglary of and other kinds of thefts of high price levels. What we found that in some of these communities, yes, they did have higher crime rates than the citywide mean, but in others, they were actually lower than the citywide mean. So in Greater Rosemount and Clifton, Berea, and in Southern Park Heights, they all had crime rates that were significantly below the mean at that time, which was 105 crimes per 1,000 inhabitants.
Tell me something about these returning prisoners. I mean, how old do they tend to be? Do they tend to have kids?
Yes. They, on average, they're about 34 years of age. The majority of them have children, particularly among the women. Nearly all of them have children, many of them minor children. And perhaps this may surprise some, but despite their extensive histories of drug use, they're cycling in and out of the correction system, their bonds with their children are quite strong.
Is there a trend? Is there a pattern? Is a child with a parent who's been incarcerated more likely to end up in prison, him or herself?
I think that there's some research to suggest that that's true, but I don't think it's as a certainty as some people believe. And the reason is that it's very difficult to research. A lot of people are exposed to parental incarceration in these communities. So at some point in their lives, one or both parents might have served time, either in prison or jail. Is that the deciding factor on whether they end up leading a life of crime themselves? I don't think so. I think that you really need to disentangle the fact that a parent has served time from whether or not the parent is present in their lives when they're not behind bars. And, you know, I think that there's danger in assuming that children will follow in their parents' footsteps. You know, there's concern about the stigma. And on the one hand, you want to identify them in a way that you can provide supports. And, you know, if they seem at risk of juvenile delinquency and subsequent criminal behavior, you want to intervene at the outset. But on the other hand, you don't want to stigmatize them before they've even gone down that path.
You have done research with people who work with children, including children whose parents are incarcerated. What are some of the behavior and emotional challenges that these children cope with?
Again, there's no straightforward answer. It's nuanced. And I think it's nuanced because you need to be thinking about whether it's a girl whose mother is incarcerated or father is incarcerated, or whether it's a boy whose mother is incarcerated or father is incarcerated. By and large, it appears that maternal incarceration has more negative impact on children. And parental incarceration in general, for daughters, they tend to look inward. They are more likely to be withdrawn and depressed, may engage in some acts of self-harm. You know, academics go down. For the sons, they're more likely to act out, get involved in delinquent acts and so forth.
And from your research or your experience, what tends to help these kids?
Identifying children who are at risk or being affected by parental incarceration is the first step. And this is a challenge because of the stigma associated with the fact that the parent is behind bars. And you want to identify these children in a way that doesn't further stigmatize them. And then when the mother is incarcerated, the child is more likely to be in the care of others. It could be a grandmother or an aunt, but regardless, they tend not to have the attention and the support that they would get otherwise. So finding surrogates for that, we actually convened a focus group of the big brothers and big sisters to ask them, you know, what do you perceive to be the issues and challenges for these kids, and how can they best be helped? And one of the surprising responses we got from them is that these kids can best be helped by supporting their temporary caregivers, who are just so strapped for resources, for support. You know, they're often raising their children and someone else's children, and so the more support that the caregivers can get, the better off the children will be.
Dr. Levine, I really appreciate your talking to us about it. Thank you.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Nancy Levine is director of the Justice Policy Center at the Urban Institute. At our website, linesbetweenus.org, we have links to Dr. Levine's reports on Maryland's prison and reentry population and her research on children of incarcerated parents. This is The Lines Between Us on 88.1 Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. With me now to talk about some of the realities faced by Baltimore City's children, teenagers, and young adults is Adrienne Muldrow, Program Manager for the Druid Heights Community Development Corporation, or CDC, We Can Achieve program. We Can Achieve is a 16-week program that aims to help young people, 16 to 24, complete juvenile probation and job training, as well as teach them alternatives to destructive behaviors. Adrienne Muldrow, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I feel honored to be here.
Where did the idea for We Can Achieve come from?
I came up with the concept while I was incarcerated. You know, I've spent, unfortunately and fortunately to a degree, over 20 years of my life in prison.
What kind of charges?
CDS. You know,
CDS, controlled
dangerous substances. You know, I sold drugs, and you know, I was wrongly accused, also and convicted life in 20. And
was for a murder charge.
Yes, ma'am.
That was overturned.
Yes, ma'am. That last stint, I started to see what was happening in society and the impact it was having on young people. I mean, young people were, like, empty. You know, the basketball court in the weight room is full. and the law
in prison,
and the law library is empty. So I got involved with the inmate council. I became the inmate council president. I was given an opportunity to speak to some young people. So before I spoke to them, I prayed and I came up with this concept, we can achieve.
Who is the young person you're trying to reach? Are all of them ex-offenders?
No, ma'am. We try to reach everybody that comes through the door, to be honest. So it doesn't matter whether that young person has had a brush with the criminal justice system or if that person has, just decided to drop out of school. Sure, we target the Department of Juvenile Services and that particular population, but our doors are open to those young people that hear about us and are willing to come in either for the group sessions and or, if they're interested, the academic component.
So what kind of personal challenges are they carrying in when they come into your program?
It's a lot. These young people, from the outset, you don't see it. You have to do a home visit to really understand this young person. Like, we had this one young person, I'm not going to say his name, but we used to wonder why he always used to sit kind of quiet in the corner. He was so disengaged. And so we did a home visit. We popped up on him, and we came to find that him, his mother, his sister, and his sister's daughter was living in a room. Home circumstances plays a major role in some of the challenges in these young people's self-esteem, because peer pressure, cause these young people to make bad decisions, obviously. And if your home is not right, you get your validation from the street. So, you know, a lot of these young people act out because they're seeking validation, because they're not getting it at home.
On 88.1, The Lines Between Us, I'm Sheila Cast. I'm speaking with Adrienne Muldrow, program manager for the Druid Heights CDC We Can Achieve program. What percentage would you say of the kids in the community, would you say, have a family member or a friend who is incarcerated or who has been incarcerated?
Wow, when you added the friend piece in there, if you would have said family member, I would have said about 60%. I would take that number up to about maybe 70 to 75%. It's almost like a rites of passage in some urban settings. You know, it's almost like what we like to say, the glory and the shame is misplaced, where a person who spent 4 years in college is not appreciated, you know, in the community, but a person, you know, little Johnny who just gave him 4 years flat, he come home, it's a party. So
party because he was there, or party just because
he was there and he came home. He's validated now because he went through 4 years of incarceration, and the mindset is that, you know, he's thorough. You know, he's a man.
Okay, so how do they look at you?
They look at me like a guy who has been there and done that, who has some wisdom about both sides and can show them the way.
What do you tell them about prison?
Well, I keep it honest. You know, I explain how I too, you know, I was impressionable. I felt like, wow, you know, this guy, he's in a BMW or a Maserati. Wow, I want to be that. I want to, you know, and I also talked about the pain that came with me wanting to be that person. You know, I had the shiny car, but when I went behind the wall, the people that I drove in that shiny car wouldn't accept my call, wouldn't send me $20. And I paint a vivid picture of the pain. And I try to paint so much of a vivid picture that young people can see themselves in it. You know, because until they see themselves in that pain, then they won't recognize it. They won't identify with it and take it on and make a different decision.
You've been doing We Can Achieve how long now?
For about almost 4 years now.
And how many young people have been through it?
About 150.
Tell me the story of one who really changed
his
or her life.
Yep. You know what? I want to say his name too. Hyman is my guy. The other day I was on my way to work, and this young guy that was on home detention, He was under 22. He was carrying some sheetrock. And he had the job for over a year now. And when I saw him, I blew my horn. And he looked over and he put the sheetrock down. I'm holding traffic up. And he said, "Mr. Adrian, how's it going?" It just warmed my heart, because when you see how these young people come in and you see what they're thinking, and when you can tap into a side of them that causes them to say, "Hey, you know what? Let me try something different." It's amazing.
What support do you think made the difference for him? I mean, I'm sure it's a lot of things, but why is he doing well when so many don't?
Well, I think it has a lot to do, number one, with personal decisions. Number two, it has something to do with people reinforcing personal decisions.
What made the difference for you? You're what? You're about 7 years out of prison?
Yes, ma'am. Determination. I vowed, you know, to never put myself in a situation that, number one, would devalue who I am as it relates to God. Number two, I felt like I was much better than the person that I was behind the bars. And number three, my 23-year-old son, who is repeating the cycle, that broke me. So I said, I need to do something about it. And then I have a 6-year-old. And my wife, obviously, because she cracks the whip. She keeps me focused.
She's your support system.
Yes, indeed.
Your older son is where?
Baltimore County Detention Center.
On what kind of charges?
Attempted murder. Yep. Blows my mind. It brings me to tears every time I think about it. But that just... it speaks to the fact that I had custody of him. That's all he saw. I never exposed him to any of that, but it's all he saw. He lived in a community that was filled with drugs and crime, and I wasn't there. So, prime example. You know, but I'm there for him. When I came home this time, I was this new guy. And he was like, "Hey, who are you?" It's been times where I've literally snatched him off the corner. And that don't work, you know. It doesn't work to go out and try to force somebody to do something that they really don't want to do. You have to appeal to, you know, their sense of personal responsibility. That's why I reference personal responsibility with Hyman, because if these kids are used to making $300, $400, $1,000 a day, you have to appeal to their personal responsibility. If it's dollars and cents, you have to say, "Hey, stop doing this and do this," and have those things ready. If you work with them until you feel that they can be committed enough to work on a job. And I just didn't have enough time with my son. But, you know, if it's God's willing, he gets out, I never turn my back on him. I got him, but he got to be ready.
You said more than 100 kids have been taken part in mm-hmm. We Can Achieve. Mm-hmm. How many of them do you feel are pretty solidly on a good road, and how many do you worry about?
About 35%.
Are doing
well. Somebody sat here and told you 50% of the participants in their program dealing with this particular population did well. I would want to question that. The reason that I worry about...
So it's uphill.
It's uphill. The reason I worry about those 65% is because they're not ready. And sometimes it takes something really, really serious to happen in their lives for them to get it. You know what I mean? It's unfortunate, but they are hard to get to.
Thank you for this conversation. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. I appreciate the opportunity.
Adrienne Muldrow is the program manager for the Druid Heights CDC We Can Achieve program. We have a link to information about the program and a link to Muldrow's video interviews with some of the We Can Achieve kids at our website, linesbetweenus.org. Funding is an issue right now for the We Can Achieve program. If you'd like to help, Muldrow's contact information is also at our website. That's it for the Lines Between Us today. Next week, we'll continue a discussion about what can interrupt the cycle of incarceration. I'm Sheila Kast. This is WYPR. After a break, Maryland Morning returns with Tom Hall and Nigerian-Ghanaian author Taye Selassie. Stay with us on 88.1.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Lines Between Us, WYPR's year-long exploration of inequality in the Baltimore region. This is Maryland Morning senior producer Lawrence Lanahan. Now, join the conversation at facebook.com/thelinesbetweenus or tell us your story at linesbetweenus.org. The Lines Between Us is made possible by grants from Associated Black Charities, Cohen Opportunity Fund, Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation, Baltimore Community Foundation, and Open Society Institute Baltimore, as well as support from members of the WYPR Board of Directors. I hope you'll join us again on Friday at 9 a.m. on 88.1 FM in the Baltimore region, and everywhere else, streaming live at WYPR.org. Have a great day.